Welcome to Crossroads, a podcast that explores the intersection of faith and Christian living. Crossroads is part of the media ministry at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City. Get to know us by visiting us online at fapc.org.
Hi, I'm Jamie Staley. I'm the Director of Christian Education at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church. Welcome to Crossroads Podcast. This fall, we are talking about faith and leadership. And so I thought that for our Crossroads podcast, we would also cover this same topic. And I'm bringing in some folks to share a little bit about faith and leadership, faith and activism from a few different points of view. I'm thrilled this morning to have Dr. Tobin Miller-Shearer with me. He is a history professor and director of the African American Studies Program at the University of Montana. And what interested me initially was his book, Religion and Social Justice Movements, which takes a look at how activists have used religious resources, such as liturgy, prayer, song, and vestments throughout the years. And in particular, the way that activists like the Water Protectors have used religious resources and their faith. So welcome, Dr. Shearer. I am really thrilled to be talking with you today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation. I always am thrilled to have people engage my scholarship as an academic. That doesn't happen every day, so I'm happy it's happening this day.
Oh, well, wonderful. How did you become interested in this particular, looking at religion and social justice movements?
Yeah, the book that came out of my dissertation was a study of the engagement of white and black Mennonites in the civil rights movement. And as a part of that study, I came across a number of images and references to points at which activists had brought particularly public prayer into the midst of their protest. And a couple of the instances that I was examining didn't go like I had anticipated they would. We often think of prayer as something that can pacify a situation, bring the tension down. But in many of the instances that I was examining, it did the opposite. It created crisis in a way that was at points sought by those praying in public, but at a point a little bit beyond their control. And I thought, there's something else going on here that I need to pay more attention to. So that started my interest in this project.
Oh, that's so interesting. I would have thought the same thing, that it would have brought things down. So can you tell us a little bit about some other examples of faith or religion influencing social protest movements that you've looked at?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So in the book you referenced, I chose a number of national and international sites where there was particularly strong evidence of religious resources being brought into the organizing effort. So I look at the efforts of Mahatma Gandhi to achieve independence in India from Britain. We looked at the civil rights movement, building on my previous work. Looked at the solidarity movement in Poland, particularly the use of the Black Madonna, a sacred painting, in pilgrimage throughout the country as part of their protest efforts, including these fascinating instances where the communist officials arrested the painting. Just so rich for exploration. Then I looked at the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, the anti-abortion movement, and the Dakota Access Pipeline Water Protectors Movement, all of which used religious resources in different ways to bring about their ends or to seek their ends. Again, in some points where there were unanticipated outcomes and in points in which things went in the way the organizers had intended.
That's so interesting. I'd love to at some point hear more about that, the Black Madonna in Poland. That's a very fascinating one to me.
Oh, it's just so, so fascinating, particularly because after it was arrested, they took an empty frame to represent the painting and moved that through the pilgrimage using it exactly as if it had been present in terms of the way they venerated it and handled it. The symbolism, the layers of symbolism there is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, almost a martyrdom of the painting. Interesting.
Yeah, you could make that argument for sure.
And I'd love to talk particularly about the water protectors, that section that you had, looking at different types of leadership and faith and activism. I found myself, a lot of what we're doing this fall, looking at fairly big movements that have been nationwide. And Standing Rock and the water protectors was something that I think people focused on, but it was almost like a short time that the whole country was focused on it. And so I would love to hear more about where you saw the water protectors using religion there.
Sure. This example, this case study, stood out from the other ones I examined in part because the use of religious resources wasn't just in the orchestrated moments of protest. It was throughout the camp daily life practices. So as we may remember, as part of the Standing Rock protest, there were a series of encampments led by Native Americans set up around the protest of the Dakota Access Pipeline in an effort to stop that pipeline from proceeding. And as had been done in other sites, there would be ritualized prayers offered almost always at the beginning of a protest, often with drums, often with smoking of sacred pipes. That was similar to what happened elsewhere. But in this particular instance, there were sacred fires burning 24/7 at all the camps. There were organized prayers happening as people went about their daily practices. Non-Indigenous folks were invited to participate in them with some very particular guidelines that were offered. It was perhaps the most holistic presence of religious resources in any of the sites I studied, but also it was the most unfamiliar practices in terms of those that they were facing. So for instance, in the civil rights movement, when African-American activists prayed in public, say they kneeled in the street and there were white police officers or other officials approaching them, they knew what was going on as people bowed their heads, kneeled in the street. They were familiar postures of prayer. In the case of the water protectors movement, the state police officers, the hired guns, if you will, that were there to protect the pipeline, didn't always understand what was happening with the playing of sacred drums, with the smoking of a sacred pipe. They knew that something was happening that set it apart from normal everyday practice. This was there was a cultural practice, there was a sacred practice happening, but there wasn't that immediate recognition of it as religious. And this complicates it then, because part of the power that emerges from the introduction of these religious resources into social protest is that everyone knows the symbolism and what they mean. But here there's a disjuncture. And so there wasn't necessarily more violence associated with the introduction of those religious resources, but there was definitely more confusion on the part of those who were reading and engaging with them who were not the water protectors themselves.
So what then do you think is the purpose of adding these in there?
Well, I think it's multi-layered and multifaceted. It's context specific. I can talk about some of there's both the intentionality of the activists in bringing them into the place and then what happens in the midst of that intention. I have a list at one point in the book, maybe I'll just sort of reference all the things that goes on. So it sustains the activists. That's part of it, right? Because this, you know, in engaging in these actions, they're drawing on religious strength. That seems pretty obvious. At points, it offers a degree of respectability. So if you're engaging in, say, an act of public prayer, there's a formalizing, and if it's recognized as such, depending upon the kind of religion that's brought in, or even, let's say, the act of a priest wearing a clerical collar or a religious sister, a nun wearing her habit, that adds that layer of respectability and sometimes protection, not always. Definitely in the case of the South African anti-apartheid movement, clergy wearing collars were not beaten as violently as those who were dressed in more secular fashion. So that's another. It also motivates sacrifice on the part of those who are engaging it, that having a sense of that what I call sacred surety in the book increases their ability to take greater risks. It can destabilize the status quo simply by, well, wait a second, isn't prayer something that happens only in churches, you know, inside those established sacred spaces? What's happening here that makes people uncertain? We've talked about it prompting violence. Again, in the example of the civil rights movement, I read this as an example of the activists claiming sacred authority for what they did and denying that to those they are protesting against. So integrationists, they're saying God's on our side, and you segregationists, you're denied that. So that also is an example of this. It also has a very interesting ability to create the reality that's being sought. So the anti-apartheid activists who would pray in integrated groups were actually achieving the vision that they sought in the society in the act of praying itself. The African-Americans engaged in the civil rights movement who prayed in public, created a space that they owned, that they were in control of, that was denied them in other aspects of society. It was a way to express culture and tradition. Multiple things go on in that act of bringing religious resources to bear on the conflict at hand. So within that, there's this richness and complexity to what I first thought was just like, oh, they want people to know they're Christians or that they're Hindus or that they are members of the Jewish community. And that symbolism itself was all that was at play. Couldn't have been more mistaken. So many layers, so many levels. That's largely been ignored in the scholarship. And I think even in sort of popular representations of these actions, they've been just sort of seen as a very simplistic, oh, of course, the Catholics who are engaged in anti-abortion efforts, they're going to pray because that's who they are. Well, it's a bit more complex than that.
Interesting. So taking it back to the water protectors then, I know you said it caused more confusion maybe than tension. What would you say that, you know, just in my initial thought, you did mention, you know, that it adding in the tradition, what did that accomplish there?
So there it was a particularly important to understand the cultural context of what the water protectors understood in their own minds that they were doing. So many of them spoke both in public settings and in private settings about their relationship with the Missouri River, that this was a relative, and they talked about praying to that relative. So there was a whole context of their relationship which frames everything they do that follows. They are engaged in this as a natural outgrowth of their cultural traditions, which saw this web of support and connectivity, and they had a particular role. In much of it, we also hear the activists there talking about women's particular role in that protective capacity, and that was honored by many of the men who were engaged in activism as well. And so there were, very early on, there was a pilgrimage of sorts along the Missouri River to the camps that was led by women, that's very resonant of those religious traditions within the community. All of that activism was seen as growing out of that relationship, which itself was growing out of the religious cultural context of those native communities who were engaged in trying to stop the polluting of that river.
Hmm. Oh, that's so interesting. Do you think that the faith-based rituals, the religion-based rituals, could contribute to a sense of solidarity within these communities?
Oh, absolutely. So the reference I made earlier to the Polish Solidarity Movement, that was one of the biggest things that's going on in the midst of the veneration of the Black Madonna and that movement forward. I use the concept of ceremonial revolution, where I taught there's the political revolution, but one of the things that's happening in the midst of that veneration and some of the mass, the large Catholic masses, the massive masses that the Pope came and oversaw within the Solidarity Movement was a revolution of values. It's challenging the stated values of the communist state at that point with the dignity of human beings, with a different notion of freedom that challenged the values of the state. And through that ceremony, through those acts of ritual, those communal values are enforced, they are strengthened, and they're validated. And that validation through those religious resources, through those religious practices being brought into public and tied to movements for resistance is in essence a collective exercise, and one that reminds people there's something out there that we want to be different than than is currently being practiced. I argue that much of the activity that brings these religious resources into the midst of social protest movements is a one that's oriented to the future. There's a time element to the ceremonies, that we're looking to the future, we're not satisfied with the present, and we want to use our bodies. I come up with these academic terms, for better or worse. I talk about the corpus chrono, the body and time. It's you. But when you take that act of prayer in the public, you're claiming a space, and again, envisioning the future, you're embodying that future by the act of prayer itself, by the act of protecting the river. You're creating a future with your body. You're looking to the future, not just to a present that you're dissatisfied with. We want that religion to take us to some place we've not yet been.
Are there ever tensions, or have you seen challenges when faith-driven activism or religious kind of using these things has caused problems with other forms of advocacy that's kind of traveling along the same path?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So again, in the Water Protectors Movement, there were both members of the indigenous community and some white activists who'd been drawn into it who were very frustrated with all the praying. There's one quote I reference in the book where a self-identified Native American participant says, what's with all the praying? We could do nothing at home as well as here. We want action. We want people to be arrested. But here you're praying all the time. It was a specific instance where there was preparation to wade across a river onto Turtle Island, where there was a lot of digging happening, and the elders pulled them back, and instead they just engaged in drumming and prayer. And as has been the case in several other instances over time, whenever leaders do that, and often with a religious overlay, that can create a lot of tension, particularly in those who don't offer or don't invest the same meaning in the religious resources as do some other participants. For some, it's intrinsically valuable to do that, regardless of the political outcomes achieved. For others who don't buy into that, tension emerges within the movement itself. Absolutely.
What would you say to folks who are within activist circles or are consider themselves contemporary activists in terms of drawing from spiritual roots of past movements? What are some lessons they could take from some faith-driven protests?
I'm often hesitant to do that because I think most of the movements I've studied, it's been very organic. It's emerged from the spiritual practices and belief systems of those who were engaged in it. I guess the one thing I could say is that organizers should recognize that those who bring those religious resources into the organizing efforts, on the one hand, you know, shouldn't be discouraged from doing so, because in terms of authenticity, that often is a key component of people feeling valued in the midst of organizing work. They can bring their whole selves in, and for many people, those spiritual practices are going to be part of particularly risk-taking initiatives that they bring. That's going to be really important to recognize that. But then also to recognize that when that happens, when people bring religious resources, whether it's vestments, whether it's songs, whether it's prayer practices, you know, the burning of sage, whatever that may be, you don't know the outcomes. It's a volatile practice and is not perhaps as predictable as some other organizing protest practices. That one, my study would suggest, has a particular power, but it's often very difficult to channel or control that power because of its volatility. Historically, at least, that's been the case. So I think you don't want to avoid it, but you also want to recognize that you need to handle this with care, just as you would, I don't know, a stick of dynamite, to use a more violent image. But it can be used for good, right? I mean, this can blast things open and that need to be blasted in construction or whatever, but it also can do great damage. So I think both of those are true within this.
Do you think that religion within social protest movements provides for better outcomes, or does it more often hinder a movement, or does it just really depend on the what's going on?
Well, I always turn back to context, particularity. Where I've studied it, in the instances that I've studied, it has been an important factor. I think we can't imagine any of those that I've named earlier unfolding like they did without religion having been present. I think if I had to sort of, from a really macro view, assess the role of religion in the social movements, protest movements I've studied, I'd say overall it's brought more to the table of positive benefits than negative ones. Overall, I think that's probably true. And again, mostly because it was a largely authentic for those who brought it. Now, there are instances where, say, in the civil rights movement, there were activists who engaged in public prayer and were clearly using that to deliberately antagonize those in front of them because they wanted a negative reaction, because they knew with the press around that was going to get more coverage. So that wasn't quite as authentic. But then there's many, many other instances where people were in the midst of crisis and they fell to their knees and prayed because that's what they did when they're in the midst of crisis, happened to be in public. So again, lots of different ways it gets brought in. I think that's the biggest takeaway I would suggest, that it's not just one thing to bring these, it's many, many things and very powerful things, often unpredictably so.
I have one last question, and this is always my favorite question, because I think it's fun to know what you found most compelling, which in researching these social justice movements, what was your favorite?
I think for me, there's this one image. I actually begin the book with it, from the 1962 Albany civil rights desegregation campaign. Was particularly religious in its expression, lots of music. The founder of Sweet Honey and the Rock, Bernice Johnson Reagan, who just passed away recently, may she rest in power, was a big part of that. But there was an image that was captured by a photographer of a young woman on her knees, impassioned in her prayer in terms of her body. She was fully in the moment. She's praying, and we can just catch glimpses of police officials around her, and they're letting her do her thing. I mean, she had claimed that space as her own, and they were not about to sort of disrupt what was going on. It was an ecstatic moment. There are people around her who are in the midst of that. And it was fully authentic from all the evidence we have in front of us. That moment sticks with me as indicative of, I think, one of those times where it was evident that there was something going on here that was bigger than anyone at an individual level, or if those religious resources hadn't been brought to bear, that created a space that wouldn't otherwise have existed.
Thank you. That was actually the perfect lead-in. I was going to end by letting folks know what we're talking about next month. Next month, we will be joined by Reverend Dr. Anne Marie Mingo, who will be talking with us about Black church women's faith, courage, and moral leadership in the civil rights movement. So thank you so much, Dr. Shearer, for joining me today.
You're very welcome.
This has been so interesting to hear a little bit more about how religion has been used in political activism, and just giving folks just kind of a taste of what that has looked like. So thank you very much for joining me, and folks, I hope you'll join me again next month.
Thank you for listening to Crossroads. Our managing editor is Jamie Staley, and our editors are Vashina Brisbane and Emily Dombroff.